I asked him what was going on, and he said those talks will continue in earnest this coming week, actually.
Our chief White House correspondent finds out about the restart of U.S.-China trade talks. It's Thursday, July 4th in most of the world, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, an expert on international economics surmises that the resumed talks might very well fail. China takes on Great Britain's reaction to Hong Kong protest, and a court in Sydney has charged two men arrested during counterterrorism raids with involvement in the Islamic State terror group, all on VOA Asia. Trade talks between the U.S. and China broke down in May with no agreement, hours after President Donald Trump more than doubled tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese imports. Trump asserted on Twitter that there was no need to rush to get a deal between the world's two biggest economies, and later added that the tariffs may or may not be removed depending on what happens with respect to future negotiations. However, VOA's chief White House correspondent Steve Herman joins us via Skype with word that the resumption of talks will happen in the very near future.
We had a bit of an encounter with Larry Kudlow, who is the director of the National Economic Council, out on the north driveway in front of the West Wing of the White House on this sweltering day. And we wanted to get some answers from him about what is going on with the trade talks with China, because the president, when we were in Osaka, said everything was back on track and that negotiators for both the countries were already speaking on the telephone. So I asked him what was going on, and he said those talks will continue in earnest this coming week, actually. And then I followed up asking Kudlow if the discussions will be face-to-face. He replied in the affirmative, noting they will be led by the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin with their respective staffs and trade principals. Kudlow said, "We will be very involved now." I asked him if the Americans will be traveling to China or the Chinese will be coming here, and Kudlow replied, "I don't know yet."
Did you get any kind of inkling as to what was expected from these talks?
Well, I think what everybody's expecting that we'll go from a truce, which we have had since the Xi Jinping-Donald Trump meeting in Osaka last Friday, to an agreement, a peace treaty to end this trade war. That is the goal here, because what we have right now are these tariffs that both sides have imposed on each other, which presumably is doing some economic damage to Chinese companies and hurting some American companies who rely on parts and manufacturing in China as well.
Well, the two top leaders of China over the past few days or the last week or so seem to have widened the scope of what they might expect that they weren't expecting when the talks fell apart the last time. Do you have that same kind of reaction?
Well, we're not really clear on what is going to be immediately accomplished. Now, there were some concessions essentially given to the Chinese by Donald Trump on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Osaka. The president did not go ahead with an additional $300 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods, tariffs up to 25%, which he had threatened. And also there's some wiggle room regarding Huawei, this Chinese telecommunications giant that is considered a national security threat by the United States government. The U.S. Commerce Department Tuesday has confirmed that it will look at opening up some of these licenses again for Americans who want to export some of their technology to Huawei, which it uses in its products. We also discussed that with Larry Kudlow, who describes it as a slight opening of the general merchandise applications for export licenses. But both he and the Commerce Department are saying that they will continue to have the highest level of national security scrutiny concerning anything that American companies are going to be doing with Huawei. And something else that Kudlow mentioned, and what we I think that what they're looking for is signs of good faith in the coming days and weeks and months by China, and that it will go ahead with its commitment to purchase significant American products, especially in the agricultural sector.
Is there any possibility that this thing has been revealed to you that the talks will regather and restart in so many hours rather than days or weeks that the U.S. president might want to announce something in his July 4th speech here in Washington about it?
I don't see any indications of that. As far as the speech that the president is going to give, and there were some questions today to administration officials about that, we can expect the focus to be on the accomplishments of the Trump administration in the economic sphere, but also rebuilding the military. But no, we're not expecting any big announcement from the president about some Chinese trade agreement. But I got to tell you, Ira, I never saw the meeting happening between Kim Jong-un and President Trump at the DMZ, and senior administration officials also seem to be caught unaware in the days before that historical event. So, as you know, with this administration, anything is possible. But I expect that any sort of significant announcements regarding China, besides an announcement that the trade talks are resuming, is still some time off in the distance.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. As always, Steve, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Ira.
Stay with us here on VOA Asia. You'll hear from an expert on international economics and what he thinks will happen when the U.S.-China trade talks do resume. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Rahul Gandhi has quit as head of India's main opposition Congress party, taking responsibility for its humiliating rout in recent general elections. At least 11 people died, 13 went missing after a small coastal dam burst in India's Maharashtra state due to heavy monsoon rains that have caused havoc in the country's western region. U.S. President Trump will host Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan later this month at their first meeting. Officials and analysts in Islamabad hope it could mean a change in often acrimonious bilateral relations. Chaos erupts at the 90th birthday party of former Philippine First Lady Imelda Marcos on Wednesday, when more than 130 friends and supporters are rushed to Manila hospitals with suspected food poisoning. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. When renewed trade talks between the U.S. and China resume, the question that arises is if those talks might lead to some kind of agreement or agreements that have yet to materialize. That is just the question I asked Alan Deardorff, professor of international economics at the University of Michigan.
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, for one thing, what they just did was exactly the same thing that they did, was it 6 months ago? I mean, where, you know, the tensions were building up and we had put bunches of tariffs on and we were promising more tariffs. And then they met and they said, okay, we'll have a truce. Well, they did exactly the same thing this time. So we're right, at best, we're back where we were then. And nobody knows, even if we have successful talks, what they would end up with. I can't imagine they will end up with us going back to the trading situation we had prior to Trump. getting rid of all these tariffs that he's added on them and on others. I can't imagine that being the outcome of this. And I'm sure the best that China feels they can hope for is to avoid further tariffs and maybe get some of the existing tariffs reduced and some of them removed. But I can't believe they would expect they're going to be able to get it all gone. It's just that's not the nature of our tariff man. I don't think so. No, we're not going to get back to where we were before, I don't think.
Well, how can we get back to some kind of any definition of normalized trading again?
Well, I mean, this isn't very helpful, but the only answer I can think of, and I'm not even sure it would work, is simply that we move to a different president. If Trump is out of office somehow, and I presume that's the only likely way that's going to happen is if he doesn't get reelected, then whoever replaces him will be in a position that they, I hope, would reverse a great deal of the things that he has done, not just in the trade area, but in other areas as well. The trouble with trade is that once you put a bunch of tariffs on there, you get more and more industry that is behind those tariffs and is benefiting from them and is expanding their operations to take advantage of the tariff. Now, there's plenty of other industries that are being hurt by them, of course, but you're developing a group within the economy that is bound to push back against getting rid of the tariffs. As a businessman, this is relevant to is the trade deficit. He thinks the trade deficit is a terrible thing. And from a business's point of view, of course, if you are spending more than you're taking in, you're going to go out of business. You're going to go bankrupt. That's totally valid for a business. It's not valid for a country. For a country, we can and do spend far more than we're taking in from our exports. And we are able to finance that really quite effectively by basically getting the rest of the world to lend to us, which they're happy to do because our financial assets are, first of all, they're in dollars, which is the strongest currency. They're backed, a lot of them, by the U.S. government, which is a strong government. So the deficit isn't the negative thing for a country that it would be for a business. I'm sure Trump doesn't understand this, doesn't believe this. If I were talking to him, he would just say, I'm spouting nonsense. And because he thinks he has a lot of experience as a businessman, which in some sense, I guess he does. So, yeah, I think he does think he's trying to run the country the way he's run businesses. And that's a terrible thing to do. But I don't know how anybody's going to convince him otherwise.
As you would expect, the Trump administration has refuted many ideas, as explained by Professor Alan Dierdorf, who spoke with us via Skype from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Happening now in Asia, a rare bombing in the Pakistan-administered part of the disputed Kashmir region has killed at least 5 soldiers and injured another. A military statement said the deadly blast occurred a few meters from the line of control that separates Pakistani and Indian portions of the divided Himalayan territory. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. China has accused Great Britain of flagrant interference after it voiced support for anti-government protesters in Hong Kong. Britain has warned Beijing of serious consequences if it breaches the handover agreement signed between the two countries over the status of the territory. Pro-democracy supporters are urging Britain to do more, claiming it has a legal and moral duty to stand up for the freedom of Hong Kong's people. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
The Union Jack flag has been a prominent symbol amid the pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong, an ironic display of defiance as the territory marked the 22nd anniversary of handover from British to Chinese rule Monday, this year overshadowed by violent protests. The demonstrations were triggered by an attempt to force through an extradition bill, allowing Hong Kong suspects to be prosecuted in mainland China. Speaking Tuesday, Britain's Foreign Secretary warned such a law would breach the handover agreement.
The UK signed an internationally binding legal agreement in 1984 that enshrines the one country, two systems rule, enshrines the basic freedoms of the people of Hong Kong. And we stand foursquare behind that agreement, foursquare behind the people of Hong Kong. And there'll be serious consequences if that internationally binding legal agreement were not to be honoured.
China hit back Wednesday.
The UK placing itself as the protector at every turn is a purely self-constructed delusion. I would like to ask Mr. Hunt, during the British colonial era in Hong Kong, was there any democracy to speak of? Hong Kongers didn't even have the right to protest.
Beyond Sino-British relations, there are wider implications for Beijing, says analyst Steve Sang.
The key issue here really is not only about our obligations to Hong Kong, it's also about how China deals with international agreements.
The 1997 handover was widely seen as the final curtain call on the British Empire. The British governor of Hong Kong at the time, Chris Patten, wants London to do more.
We should have a sense of honour about Hong Kong, and we should have a specific sense of our obligations to the individual citizens of Hong Kong. And that means speaking up about what's been happening.
But Britain's options are limited, thanks to Brexit, argues Tsang.
China is a rising power and is potentially the second superpower. The UK is getting into a stage of uncertainty about its future. So we are not in a particularly strong position compared to China in trying to resolve any disputes we may have with China at the moment.
Beijing says the protests are an internal matter and any foreign efforts to interfere are, in its words, destined to be futile. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Coming up, the United Nations has some harsh words for Myanmar. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. Demonstrators fearful of repercussions from Monday's violence when protesters stormed and vandalized Hong Kong's Legislative Council building had their worst fears confirmed last night when police announced the arrest of at least 12 protesters. Those nabbed, aged between 14 and 36, were alleged to have possessed offensive weapons, taken part in unlawful assembly, and attacked police officers. VOA Asia continues now. A UN investigator says the United Nations and international community have failed to hold the government of Myanmar accountable for decades of persecution and repression against the minority Rohingya Muslims. The report from the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar is under discussion at the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from that council in Geneva.
The chair of the Commission of Inquiry on Burundi warns the democratic space in the country is rapidly shrinking. Senegalese lawyer Dudu Dien says the government's efforts to convince observers the situation has returned to normal since the 2015 political crisis ring hollow. President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a controversial third term in 2015 provoked deadly clashes, prompting hundreds of thousands of people to flee the country to escape threats and violence. Dien, who presented the Commission's report to the UN Human Rights Council on Tuesday, says serious human rights abuses have continued. He says the abuses have a political dimension as they occurred following the May 2018 referendum, which amended the constitution, allowing Nkurunziza to run for at least two more terms. Speaking through an interpreter, Dien says most of the victims are opponents and members of a new party aimed at defeating the ruling party.
Members of this party are regularly subject to threats, arbitrary arrests and detentions, beatings, even torture. The party itself faces several challenges in conducting basic activities, such as organizing meetings or opening offices.
Dien says the commission has well-founded fears about the fairness of the 2020 elections. He says free and credible elections cannot occur when only the ruling party is able to operate and when independent voices are stifled. Again, he speaks through an interpreter.
The history of elections in Burundi, including last year's constitutional referendum, has always been marred by violence and serious human rights violations. Some worrying signs can already be seen in the current pre-electoral background.
The commission is urging Burundi's government to take strong measures to renew the vitality of the democratic space, which is necessary for holding credible elections. Burundi's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Renova Tabu, has rejected the report, which he says offers an apocalyptic picture of a plan of destabilization on the eve of the election. The ambassador says the commission has presented no proof that the election could become the scene of a serious deterioration of human rights. He says it is easy to lie when claims cannot be verified and calls the commission report an act of sabotage. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news break from VOA Asia. North Korea's mission to the United Nations accused the United States Wednesday of being more and more hell-bent on hostile acts against Pyongyang, despite President Trump's wanting talks between the two countries. Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to set foot in North Korea on Sunday when he met leader Kim Jong-un in the DMZ. This is VOA Asia. A court in Sydney has charged two men arrested during counterterrorism raids there with involvement in the Islamic State terror group. Australian investigators continue to interview the alleged mastermind of an Islamic State-inspired plot to attack the buildings, including churches, courts, and embassies. He has also been accused of preparing an act of terror. More from Sydney and Phil Mercer.
The men were arrested in simultaneous raids in Sydney. 23-year-old Radwan Dadak has been charged with being a member of the Islamic State Terror Group, or IS, which is a crime in Australia. Investigators believe another man, Isaac El-Matari, who's 20, was the mastermind behind a suspected conspiracy to attack buildings in Sydney, Australia's biggest city. Senior officers have said planning for an attack was in its early stages, and that police stations, military establishments, courts and churches were potential targets. El-Matari had been under surveillance in Australia since returning from Lebanon last year. It's alleged he planned to travel to Afghanistan to fight with Islamic State extremists there. It's the 16th alleged major plot to have been foiled in Australia since 2014. Ian McCartney is the Assistant Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police.
There are still those people in the community who wish to do us harm, who wish to do the community of Australia harm. I want to say they don't represent the Islamic faith. Their actions are criminal and they represent hatred and terror.
Australia has warned of the twin threat to its national security of homegrown extremists, often radicalised online, and of militants returning home after fighting with terrorist groups overseas. A third man arrested in raids Tuesday has been charged with fraud and has been released on bail. He has not been accused of terrorism offences. Australia's national terror threat level remains set at probable, which means the authorities suspect that individuals and groups have the intent and capability to carry out an attack. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And a story now from the western United States. A hearse driver transporting a corpse was stopped by police for using a carpool lane in the U.S. state of Nevada, but let off with a warning after he claimed it counted as a passenger. The officer said that the driver said, "Doesn't it count in the back, the person in the back?" Police officer explained that passengers need to be alive to qualify for the high occupancy vehicle lanes common across the U.S. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Clevin Fowler, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a great day.